Good morning, diners and travelers. You're listening to On the Menu with Ann and Peter Haig, and we're going to give you a little dance around Nashville, Tennessee, and the Music City Food and Wine Festival.
Because we just back from there.
Yes.
And it was pretty much fun.
We had a good time.
We sure did. So we're going to bring you two programs. First one this week, second one next week, so that you've got pretty good guide to what's going on in Nashville, and also some of the famous food celebrities who just happened to wash up for the event.
Yeah, well, we start with, you know, one of my favorite chefs is Trevor Morin. As I said before, I've always had a soft spot in my heart for young Irish chefs, and he's a doll. And not only that, I mean, it's one of the best meals I've had in memory at Catbird Seat. This is really a pleasure for me. It's a treat, thank you, Rabbit, to be able to get together and talk to a chef I greatly admire and a person I have a lot of fun with, Trevor Morin. I'm not Irish enough. He is, of course, Irish. But you've worked all over the world. Can you just encapsulate some of the different experiences that you feel are significant in the development of your cooking career and style?
Hi, it's great to be back with you guys. We've stepped up the venue a bit from the Patterson House to Silo. I've worked in a few places. I probably wish to have worked in a few more places around the world, but I think overall, wherever I've been, the one thing I'll take is not so much technique and the way you should work or the way you should treat your products or whatnot, but it's just the thought process behind food and why we do what we do. And so, I guess, most recently in Copenhagen with Renee at Noma, I think I learned a great deal of respect for not just product, that's vital that all chefs have that, but it's the guest experience, I think, is something that's coming forward more and more for me, and that there's so much more to just what something does when you put it in your mouth. It's how you present it and how you treat people, and it's a respect for people. And so I guess that's what I've learned more than anything, that this is a hospitality industry, and I firmly believe that now. And I want to give people a nice time if possible. Food first. I mean, I don't even know what first, but just it's about the experience for the guests, I think.
Well, you know, I've not been to Noma, although you're going back there, and I expect I will go. I just didn't want to have a complicated reservation experience. But the atmosphere of Catbird Seat is really interesting. I actually expected that the people sitting around would interact more with each other, and they didn't. Did you expect that they would?
I mean, there's day to day, there's literally no way to know who's going to come in and how they're going to behave. I've had people move from one side of the bar, walk around and dance with people on the other side of the bar. I mean, it's rare, but it does happen that the energy can get that high. I think a lot of people who eat there expect or are hoping for maybe a little privacy sometimes. Sometimes it's a romantic date. Sometimes it's a family reunion. So there's no way to really say. I personally enjoy when the guests start to interact with each other. I think it's brilliant. It's contagious. Yes. They start hanging out. We start hanging out. And then, you know, maybe we'll even be inspired to do a little dish on the fly for them or give them something. So it really is. The more you put in, the more you can get out of it. But, yeah, no, you never know what's going to happen. You guys were very, very well behaved. That's all I'll say. Towards the beginning, anyway.
No, I mean, what? Let's jump back. What happened in Ireland? I'm particularly interested in your experiences, your early experiences in Ireland, and when you left and so forth. And a comment you made to me that before you start jumping into your new career, which we'll talk about later, that you're really looking forward to going back to Ireland and you're surprised you're so looking forward to it. I love Ireland. I love all the Irish chefs that I know there. So I just wanted to know your perspective on that part of your life, on what you actually went on there when you were there.
I guess when I say I'm most excited to get back there, or I'm surprised at myself for being excited to get back there, maybe that's a little unfair. I mean, I have family and friends there that I adore, but my cooking career there was just a few years, but the majority of it, of that time in those 7 or 8 years, were spent in a kitchen trying to survive the day, as most chefs do. And now that I've gotten to step away and go to other countries and see the different products, I started to question what's available in Ireland and what the quality is like. And through speaking to people and through sampling things and being back, it's truly stunning what's available in this island, because you have these, you know, I guess 4 distinct coasts that have everything from the best shellfish to the best lamb to the best, you know, seaweeds to wild mushrooms, wild forageables, in one way similar to Denmark, and then maybe also similar to, you know, Maine, and also similar to West Coast, you know, Portland. And it's just very exciting to see and to go back and rediscover all these things. So I'm excited to go back and see what my homeland has to offer, and, you know, hopefully get some inspiration from that. I'm hoping to do a trip before this next sort of thing in Copenhagen. I'm hoping to spend a few months traveling around and finding inspiration in things. And Ireland is first on my list for that.
I started actually a discussion which I didn't conclude, the concept that you really stepped into a well-established and well-awarded restaurant, Catbird Seat, when you took over this. What kind of changes did you make, if any?
Well, when I got there, I was, of course, intimidated by the creativity of the old chef that I was working with, which was Eric Anderson, who's now in Minneapolis planning his new restaurant, which is, of course, going to be amazing. But very much intimidated by his skill set and his dishes. And it was really the first time that I'd been asked to create my own food. And it started from day one, actually, thank God. But when I arrived, I really thought I was going to have a soft entrance, and that he would have a menu for me, and I would just prepare some food and do that. And he basically said, well, okay, you need to do a salad serving, a fish serving, a cheese serving, and a cold serving, and it has to be ready by Wednesday. And so, you know, I absolutely was terrified. And then I did it, and you know, it was pretty bad, I'll be honest. and then I got time to play in this very safe space in Nashville, which is why it's such a brilliant place for young chefs, or maybe not young, but chefs who haven't really run their own places yet, to discover themselves and discover food. So I got to do some things that were really truly awful. You could tell by the guests' faces when they ate them. Some openly complained, and then bit by bit you start to see what people actually want. And so by the time Eric had let me know that he was going to leave, I knew that I didn't want to, as much as I respected his food, I didn't want to do any of anyone else's dishes. So from day one we changed them all. And it was really stressful to begin with, and I'd love to go back and see the menu, but we just changed everything, and we started with 15 servings or something. They were all brand new and, you know, partially untested. And, you know, that first day back, I think it was January 15th, 2014, was one of the scariest moments of my life. And I was, like, really charged, and it went really well. And then it just has snowballed since then. And now I feel like we're developing a sense of self. And the funny thing is, you can't feel it happen. I think maybe it's like, you know, if you have a child and you watch it grow and you don't notice it getting older, and or you see your schoolmates years later, you know, and you can't believe it, you know, that they've aged, but your friends that are around all the time look the same. And it's like that now with the media. I look at some of the dishes we're doing, and it stuns me that the changes, you know. I think they're for the better. And I think we've made some people happy, which is, you know, really the whole point of it. So, yeah, I think I've developed a lot. I've learned a lot. I feel like the Catbird Seat was my culinary school.
Well, you certainly put together a really effective team, and that's a leadership quality that you list in your skill sets. Take us back. What transpired career-wise between when you started out cooking in Ireland and when you ended up at Noma in Copenhagen?
I guess I've been working for a few years in some different places with some very talented chefs. one who I'm still in touch with quite a lot and I respect very, very much. His name's Carl Whelan, and he's just opened a restaurant in Dublin actually called Luna, which is, I guess, Italian-Irish, if you could call it that. But he's very legitimate. I mean, he's the first chef I worked with that I truly, truly thought, this guy's amazing. He could walk into a cooler and look around and see some trout and some, you know, mushrooms and asparagus and create something that was, like, both interesting and light and fresh and respectful, you know. And we would talk about seasoning and the importance of salt versus acidity and sweetness. And I'd never really spoken to anybody about that. And that was in the very beginning. So I very much respect him. He's also a lunatic, which is lovely. He's been out to Nashville to eat, and they had a round before they opened this restaurant to do some research, which is commendable because I think a lot of restaurateurs don't do that. Maybe one of the reasons restaurants fail so much is that people don't actually try hard enough at all, and they just roll a dice and it doesn't work out. So he's a very amazing person. So I worked with him, and he really inspired me. And from there, I went to a restaurant that won a Michelin star that was, you know, for sure one of the tougher restaurants in Ireland. Still to this day, I don't think there was a taskmaster as tough as this chef. He was called Mint. He was a chef from Tom Aiken's kitchen in London. So, yeah, everyone reacts that way. Oh God, you know, because he's the man. You know, he's very driven. That's the beautiful way to describe someone who's terrifying and crazy. He's driven and he knows what he wants. And so, from seeing this side, from the first time seeing true fine dining, it really inspired me to make a decision whether I wanted to go, you know, into this world or stay behind in the other world, which is, you know, cooking as a career. And so I decided to cook for my mind, I guess, first. And since then, I've stepped away from that again. But that was the point when I decided I want to go a little further with this one. And so that led me to a food trip where I ate, and I went to Chicago. And as an Irish guy just cooking 3 years and starting out, I saved my money and I went to Alinea and I went to Moto and I went to the Fat Duck and I went to Noma and various other Scandinavian restaurants, and it began there.
So you did okay at Noma, and you got along very well with, I mean, you're going to go back there. Let's get that out of the way. You've been drafted, actually, by Rene Redzepi to go back and be head chef, which is no small matter. This is a big deal position for you. But you are going to be in the shadow of a larger-than-life personality. How do you weigh in on that?
Well, actually, the job title my say in there and whatever position doing still has to be ironed out. I won't actually be head chef. They will have another hired chef who will be head chef. A very good friend of mine, Stewie, will be running the kitchen as well, which I'm really excited about working. So my position, I think, actually will be less in the day-to-day running of things and maybe more in the, you know, creative side, I hope, and, you know, just food. It's really, you know, discovering how to make food delicious and wonderful and resonate with people is what I want to do. And, you know, the head chef position has so much more to it than that. So I still need to meet with the guys and discuss exactly what's going to happen. But it's an honor to be asked back. It's shocking. I think maybe Rene has forgotten what it was like to work with me, because if he remembered clearly, this would not be happening. But no, it's going to be wonderful. I'm honored to be part of something that's going to be truly amazing. I mean, I saw the space and I know what he's like, and it's a graffiti, you know, shed where I thought we were going to be mugged or murdered when we were there. But you can see, and there's a magic there, and he can see it, you know. It's like, you know, a sculptor looks at a block and, you know, he chisels away a form that's already there. That old doozy. But that's what it is. It's going to be wonderful, and I could never say no to it.
But he has almost surreal ambitions. This is not going to be just a reincarnation of this award-winning In-N-Out of number one in the world's 50 best, and currently three, but then probably one again. He's actually building a whole ecosystem an urban farm where this restaurant's going to be in the center, and he's going to go even more intensely, and it sounds like a very big intellectual exercise in seasonality. Is it doable, and do you think it's a bit much?
Oh, yeah, it's definitely too much. It's a nightmare and a terrible idea, but I guess it's going to be done anyway. So I think there's maybe a distinction, and maybe I'm wrong, and I don't want to speak out of place or too soon. It's not creating an urban farm to create an urban farm. It's creating an urban farm to create delicious food, and that has always been the thing. So it's what's on the plate that's going to be spectacular. And it's like for a chef to draw from things he's grown himself is really cool, and of course it's the freshest produce you could imagine. But I think it's in the restriction is what's always maybe excited me to in Noma. You know, I didn't eat a tomato for about 4 or 5 years. And, you know, you cook with what you're dealt with. And that's what you do as a cook at home, too. You know, you open the cooler, what's there? You know, you're in Scandinavia, what's there? You have your own farm, what's there? And it's for me would be to create, you know, formats where ingredients can move and play and you know, represent themselves well and be respectful of themselves and just to make delicious food, but inside of these formats. So that's what I'm very excited to learn. I mean, I'm just excited to go back and learn again. I mean, I've learned some stuff here, of course, how to run a kitchen and all those things. But I want to learn from all these great people, you know, not just Renee, but chefs and other chefs in town and also farmers and amazing cooks that work there. So I'm pumped to be part of this gigantic operation.
You said something very interesting because we said... And I know Anne agrees that the meal that we had with you the other evening was one of the 10 best meals we've probably ever had. And you said, well, I was really frightened what was going to happen when you came in, as if somehow you might have disappointed us. But looking forward, as you're still young enough to look forward to some achievements, is there some place ahead beyond the reincarnation of Noma where you think 5 to 10 years from now you expect you might be or you would hope to be?
Yeah, I genuinely don't even really think more than like a week out, so there's no way for me to say. I just hope that, you know, that I have my health and I have my friends and family around and that I can just do something. I just hope I can do something in the future. That's as simple as that. I don't have any goals other than that. I'd like to try and make some people happy. I'd like to stick food in people's mouths because I enjoy doing that. As far as where I would do something, I mean, there's always home, but I've really fallen in love with America and the South in particular. I absolutely love it here in Nashville, and I say that to people all the time in the restaurant, but I very genuinely mean it. It's like it's the greatest place I've ever lived. People are fantastic, supportive, the weather is wonderful, there's babes everywhere. It's just a really perfect, it's a perfect little town with some really great food. And so I mean, we'll see what happens. Right now, I'm just going to focus on the next 3 years. I think I'll put all my energy into that.
You've met so many different chefs. Could you tell us some of the people who have impressed you?
I mean, I think, you know, almost everybody I've met has impressed me in many ways. I mean, people are amazing, and everyone has their own skills. I went to Cezanne recently, had a fantastic meal. Daniel Burns in Luxus in Williamsburg, I very, very much love his food and his style. And when you eat, it's amazing because when you go into that restaurant, you don't feel like you're in New York anymore. It's a really unusual experience, but it's very special. And then I'm doing a pop-up in a couple of weeks with a friend of mine, Ben Sukel from Birch in Providence. He's very inspiring too in how he uses what's from the coast, but literally what comes in that day, and his approach to food is very interesting. Also, the guys in Contra in New York, which is a very small, you know, some would say scrappy restaurant, they do a smaller tasting menu, but they really get it. And so I'm inspired by all these people for many different reasons. Yeah, and in town too. I mean, there's fantastic chefs. You know, you got Tandy Wilson, who I guess you're going to eat with tonight. He was one of the people that started the food revolution here. And, you know, not for fame or anything, but just to make delicious food. And so it makes food the proper way. And, I mean, that's the most inspiring thing of all.
I don't know about you, but, I mean, Eaters just devoted this whole section to the food of the future, the restaurant of the future. I really think it's, somebody came out with a book about let's stop worrying about what we eat, and I'm beginning to feel that way. Do you understand what I'm talking about? I mean, do you really care what we're going to eat in 2054?
Oh, no, definitely. I mean, I definitely won't be around for that. I think no one in this room will be. No, I don't think so. I think a lot, there's almost too much weight put on those things. You know, food is being present. You know, it's what, it's in your mouth now, and that's what's important. It's the experience of being with people you love and eating, I guess. That's really it. So I don't give a shit about 2054.
Nor do I. I want to say this. I was very pleased to learn that you were a cat person, because I am too, and an only child, which proves again that we're nice people. And I love the fact that you keep wanting to learn, and this to me is one aspect of your personality, which makes me think that you'll keep moving around. But anyhow, here's the...
Well, don't say I want to conclude, because you might say something next that we might want to respond to. But I can tell you this, young man, we are so glad our paths have crossed. So much so that we liked you so much, we made sure our paths crossed a second time. And I hope our paths will cross many more times as your career extends and as we still have the ability to be able to get around and figure out where you are.
Oh, Trevor, thanks so much for everything, for a wonderful meal that we had, and for talking to us and sharing your ideas.
It's been an honor, and I hope to see you in Copenhagen, and if not, maybe on my food trip before that, and maybe we can go to Tokyo and get some ramen together.
In case you missed it in the interview, get to Nashville and catbird seat pretty quick, because our Trevor is off. Off to the races, going to cook around the world or eat around the world a little bit, and then go back to work for Reni Redzepi at the newly re-inspired,
reinvented
Noma.
Totally
Herman
Farm. And
yeah, and interestingly enough, another thing we discovered: a good friend of ours and a good friend of Trevor's was just named to the Michelin star list.
He got a Michelin star
for
his
Ireland.
First year of operation.
Good old Enda McAvoy, the Austrians. The restaurant's called Loam, L-O-A-M.
Right.
And at the same time, and just passing by before we forget, J.P. McMahon, who astonished the world by getting the first Michelin star in Western Ireland, kept his Michelin star at Anir for another year. So there's lots going on in Ireland. We just got to figure out how to get there. But we got a little piece of it when we were in Nashville, and it was a whole lot of fun. And now it's time to take a break.
Podcasting services for On the Menu Radio are provided by ASP Station, www.aspstation.net.
Welcome back. Our next stop is at a restaurant called Silo, which I thought was a rather odd name for a restaurant.
Well, you'll find out the reason for it when you listen to the interview.
The owner and the chef we're going to be talking to, and the owner himself is the chef. A very interesting conversation, and we'll start with a discussion of why this place is called Silo. Well, we're about to have a very interesting discussion at a restaurant called Silo in Germantown. With the owner, Clay Greenberg, who is also a chef trained, and his acting chef, and his executive chef, Alex Granger. And they have a good sense of humor, and so we're going to have a lot of fun with this conversation. Let me start with the name. And Clay, I think you were explaining to me about why it's called Silo, which I don't think Peter understood.
We wanted to pick something that was very short and simple. It is the first thing you see from a farm if you're driving on the highway very far away. And it's sort of a double meaning that, it is an elevator where you store grain. And, of course, silo is really elevated southern cuisine. It's not just, what southern food used to be. back in the maybe the 70s or 80s. I mean, we're all classically trained here. We've gone to school or we've worked for other great chefs, and we wanted to take, you know, Southern food really to the next level, to the New York City level, and I think we've done that.
Why open? You went to French Culinary Institute in New York City. Were you intent on, you said, opening a restaurant? Were you intent on coming back to Nashville and opening a restaurant? And if so, why?
I have to admit that I was, because my wife was already 2 months pregnant. I really had to come back. I wanted to stay. I'm kidding. It was great. Yeah, my plan was to go get my degree, come back, work for some other chefs, work my way up, and then, you know, when I was ready to open a restaurant, open a restaurant. And it worked out exactly like it was supposed to.
Now, you had a different chef opening, and actually you said that things weren't going that well with the restaurant at the time. Was it the same kind of menu, the same concept of food at that time?
To some degree, it was. A few of the items have been on for a long time. The hot chicken and the hamburger, which are on the bar menu, have been on for 2.5 years, I would say. The pot au creme on dessert has been on because it's gluten-free. But I really let Alex run with the rest of the stuff. You know, we always wanted to have, you know, a beef, a chicken, some kind of fish. You know, kind of the standards that everybody's going to have. But let him make his interpretation of whatever. I really don't tell him what to put on there. I just want it to be good, and if, you know, if it sells, it's great, and if somebody complains, which fortunately they haven't yet, you know, then we make some changes, but we haven't had to do that. The other part that's great about Alex is that I don't have to tell him when to change the menu. He's very active about doing that, and no dish sits around for 2 or 3 weeks and gets stale. It comes and it goes, and that's it. And in a good way, a lot of the guests sort of complain, and then they're just thrilled by what comes on next, and they've already forgotten about what they forgot about what the last dish was.
I'll tell you, Clay, you sound like a really practical guy, and it sounds like a really good team. Alex, you are not a Southern boy?
Yes, I grew up in Southwest Florida.
That's right.
Naples, Fort Myers area. It's not considered the true South, but it's still farther south than Nashville.
Well, you know, I mean, you're not like the what's it called, the Southwest Food Alliance or whatever it's called. You're not that kind of Southern chef.
No, I'm not.
So how did you come to food? Explain that.
Well, when I was 15, I actually started working at my first restaurant job, making pizzas for a local pizza shop. And I just was really good at it right away. I was better than the managers. I mean, right out the gate, I could just make pizzas better than everyone around me. Both my parents are incredible cooks. And I grew up around eating really good food. I actually went to school for business management and just kept cooking the whole time while in school. Worked with great chefs, and I was so good at cooking and loved to do it so much, I just stuck with it, and here I am.
Well, now you put your mark in a previous conversation. You said that you have European influences, you're classically trained, but you really like simple food, straightforward food. How much changing did you have to do in this menu? And talk to us a little bit about the items you have on this menu that fit into your concept of food.
Well, basically what I did, I brought down what I was doing in New York City to Silo, because what I was doing is just simple farm-to-table, humanely raised animals, you know, farm-raised. They have happy lives. They taste great. It's very important to me that the animals have a good life. Clay likes exactly what I like. He likes simple dishes made perfectly with using great local products. And that's what I specialize in. So I brought that down here, and we just clicked. And moving forward.
Well, you know, our listeners really like variations on food porn. Could you pick some dishes off this menu and sort of describe them in, you know, in detail so the people are drooling and as they're listening?
Yes, we have a bavette steak, which a lot of people don't use this cut of beef. It's actually an extension off of the sirloin, and it's the most flavorful part of the cow. You slice it thin. It's a very tender cut of meat. And ours comes from a cow. It's completely grass-fed from Georgia, from day one to the end of its life. It's grass-fed, yes. It's a French-cut bistro-style steak. It's very tender, very flavorful, and people love it. And every cut is different. It's very hard to cook correctly. Not a lot of people use it, but it's my favorite, and I know it very well, and I like to use it here. It's very popular.
How about the mother?
Well, I like to always do a potato gnocchi and keep it vegetarian. I change it with the seasons. So I actually just switched to the fall gnocchi, which involves local pumpkin, some radicchio, red onion, toasted pistachio, and once winter rolls along, I'll start doing some winter root vegetables with it. But it always stays vegetarian. We make the gnocchi in-house. And a vegetarian, it's a nice surprise for them to get this because it's such an incredible dish. They can't get that anywhere else in Nashville.
I was actually going to go back because the bavette, as you call it, it has a name in English cuisine, but it's a very famous cut in the French bistro cuisine of beef, correct?
That's absolutely correct. It's a French bistro-style steak. Another name for it is a sirloin flap, but bavette sounds a lot better.
There we go. Now this is an interesting menu. It has not one, but two cauliflower dishes, cauliflower masquerading as salad and cauliflower masquerading as steak.
Yes, we all, along with the one vegetarian gnocchi, we always have one dish that knocks out everything: vegetarian, vegan, and gluten-free. That's where the grilled cauliflower steak comes in. So I cut out the very center of the cauliflower, so it's one intact, large steak-like piece of cauliflower. Put that on the grill and make a nice sauce called romesco, which is vegan. It involves roasted red peppers, garlic, onions, tomatoes,
almonds.
It's just a great sauce. That goes right on top of the cauliflower steak. Then we toss some nice bitter dandelion greens in with quinoa. And that's our vegan dish. Cauliflower is just so versatile. I mean, we can make a nice cauliflower salad out of it like we do as well. And you can't have too much cauliflower.
And here's the dish that caught our attention and I guess pushed it over the edge and said we have to talk to these people at Silo. Is the charred octopus, which... octopus just happening to be one of my wife's favorite foods.
Well, then you're definitely in the right place for octopus.
Yeah.
Mine is very tender.
Before you jump into the answer to that, why is there so much octopus in Nashville?
I feel like, well, octopus is just a really good protein, and I mean, everyone's trying to do it, and, you know, it's a very New York thing, having octopus, and everyone's trying to do it, but I feel we're really doing it right here.
I'm not going to ask you this tongue-in-cheek, but I've understood that it's illegal to not put shrimp and grits on the menu in the South.
That is very true. It is illegal. Have to have shrimp and grits.
The other thing is, Southerners like their sweets, and you have an extensive dessert thing. Do you do dessert, or do you have a pastry chef?
We have a wonderful pastry chef named Nick Castro. The guy is phenomenal. I do desserts, but I'm not a pro at desserts. I'm a pro at dinner. So that's why we have a trained professional pastry chef. I let him do the desserts. I handle the entrees and apps, and we're just a great team.
I'm looking at this list. They have, of course, you mentioned the creme. What's Caramac pie?
The Caramac pie? Well, Caramac is actually a candy from Hawaii. Nick lived in Hawaii, and they had this candy called a Caramac, and it involves caramel, macadamia nut, and he basically took that and made a tart crust, and now it involves macadamia, caramel, and some pickled mangoes actually on it. White chocolate ganache. So we transformed this candy that he loved into an actual dessert.
did you, well, first I wanted to ask you to talk a little bit about your beverage program, because I noticed with the 2 days we've been at this festival that the attendees really like the booze. So what kind of a program, is that true, number one? And we're going to talk to Clay about this. And number two, what is your answer to this craving, this booze obsession in your list?
Well, I think to make a mark as a great Southern restaurant, you need to have a very extensive bourbon list, and we do. I think we're around 90 bourbons right now. We probably have 10 or 12 single malt scotch, 4 or 5 Tennessee whiskeys, and then lots of, bourbons from other parts around the country, just besides Kentucky. It's hopefully not a fad. I think it's sort of enjoying the attention that scotch maybe got in the late 80s when everybody thought it was a big deal to start tasting all this thing. And it's the exact same thing. I mean, you either like brown whiskeys, or you don't like it. You're a vodka person. But you will see a lot of very experienced people sitting up here talking trash about their favorites. We've got a few guests that come in, and they'll they've got huge collections. Sometimes they'll buy and sell, not to us, because we can't buy theirs, but they'll make some trades up here. And some of these are pretty incredible things. We've got a 23-year Pappy from the last of the old Weller family. We haven't opened it, but you can see that on eBay for $6,000, and it's just sitting in the vault. We're just going to leave it there all locked up tight until until we decide
to.
I don't know when, but you know what? I don't really have to worry about it. But it's a lot of fun. It's just as important, I think, as the menu, because people are so passionate about it. They really want to talk about what their favorite is, why their favorite is. It's just part of it, and it's been a real fun experience for me to learn about it, because I wouldn't say teach classes about it, but I do get asked over to the tables a lot, and people want to know, and there's only one way to find out about how a profile of whiskey is. So it's a job, but I'm volunteering to do it, and I do it, and I can tell you there's some pretty good ones out there, and it's been a lot of fun.
I think you have fun with wine names, too. I think you must choose things like the Black Chook Sparkling Shiraz, partly because of the name, and then there's a Zinfomaniac. I mean, do you just pick those up deliberately?
I'll tell you, both of those. The Zinfomaniac is the larger of the two Zins on there, and we wanted one that was just an absolute California monster, and it is a huge Zin. The Black Chook is great. My wife discovered that, and it is the ultimate hot tub wine, because it's Shiraz, so it's dark and sparkly. So when you're in the wintertime and it's cold outside and you don't want champagne when it's outside, when it's 30 degrees and you're in the hot tub, it drinks more like a red wine, even though it's sparkling. So that's why. We don't sell a whole lot of it, but the people that try it are just floored by it, because it's got such big character and such big fruit, unlike a little Pinot Noir, a Chardonnay type champagne drink, and it's just something completely different.
It's actually a great wedding wine.
Yeah.
Down under, I lived down there for several years, so I'm familiar with it. But it's a shocking wine, because it's sparkling like champagne, but yet it has this really dark red color. And I don't even know, I don't have to figure out what the color of Zinfomaniac is. I think that's probably fairly red, too.
She's dark and red.
It's a she, definitely. And you go to other countries as well, so you have a good Spanish collection, you have some Italian here, you have quite a lot of Australian. Tolbrack is a great vineyard that we like, and you have one of theirs, so, and I'm sure you're probably adding all the time.
I do change it fairly frequently, but I always want to have the big six on there, and then I try to get as many as I can. So there's 3 Chardonnays on there. There's 3 Pinot Noir. They're all completely different. Those are by far the most popular, in the United States as far as red. A couple of Cabs as well. But those 3 Chardonnays are completely different, and if I were to bring them out and taste you on there, you would see, well, that's exactly what the whole great point about having wine is. You can have 3 Chardonnays from 3 different regions of the world. They are completely different, yet they're the exact same grape.
Well, I mean, you've been here not a very long time, Alex, Chef Alex, and I'm assuming, Clay, you sound like a really smart businessman. I'm assuming you've turned Silo around and it's on the rise. Is that true?
Only partly, really. This restaurant was very successful from the very first night we opened up. I had all these years of being a chef. I had lots of press people that I knew. I had lots of friends. My wife has a great job where she's got hundreds of contacts, and that's actually, we know, his girlfriend's father and mother. So I said that jokingly that we were in trouble that month before he got here. But, you know, we've had three incredibly successful years. Germantown, this little neighborhood in Nashville, has been absolutely incredible. And we're very lucky. There's a lot of density here. People don't have to drive. They can walk here. And it is that true big city feel like you would get in Paris or in Madrid or in New York City, where you get the same people coming in, day out. They expect to be treated like royalty, and I think we do treat them that way, and they have in kind rewarded us nicely.
Well, thank you for talking to us, both of you, and I'm glad we met you.
Thank you.
Podcasting services for On the Menu Radio are provided by ASP Station, www.aspstation.net.
Welcome back. Our next stop was a restaurant called 404, which is easier to explain than Silo, I guess, because 404 is its street number, but it is built in a cargo container. A little bit unusual, so you better listen closely and you'll find out what the idea was behind that. We talked to Chef Matt Bolas, who was so incredibly busy with the Music City Food and Wine Festival. It's amazing that we actually had the opportunity to talk to him. And Travis Brazil, the general manager, who, if he sounds a little bit like Peter, there's a satisfactory explanation why, because he's originally English too. And the story of 405 is 404.
My goodness.
He's certainly very interesting. So hang in here and listen.
Well, now we're at 404 Kitchen. We do move around a bit. And we're going to be talking to two people here. First, we're going to talk to Matt Bolas, who's the executive chef, who has a very interesting background. He's lived all over the place. He's cooked all over the place. And his background is Lebanese, which also influences his menu somewhat. Matt, is there anything in your background you'd like to point out that people should know about you, your life background, your style?
I can't say there is. I learned to cook from my mom, and so I think that just to me means I make food from the heart. It's honest. It's uncomplicated. It's full of love. That's my background.
It's good for me, I'll tell you. Now we talked about the concept of this restaurant. Tell us in your words how you describe the concept of 404 Kitchen.
I would say the concept here is locally driven, sustainably driven, but we won't compromise quality for locality. Right? It still has to be of the best quality for us to use it. But we try to waste very little and find use of every part of the ingredient that we're using at the time. You know, so, for instance, the tartare, the different vegetables that find their way into various dishes as garnishes. On the rock shrimp, we use a tomato butter, and that just comes from the scraps of tomatoes that we've cut in a very precise way to look beautiful on the plate, but I don't want to throw out all those scraps, so those scraps are stewed and milled and processed and blended with butter to create this decadent sauce for another dish, and that way we don't throw everything out.
Well, your restaurant has been really highly recommended to us, so I'm expecting great things. Anyhow, how old is it? And tell me, is it attached to this hotel?
We'll be 2 years old in a month. We opened up in October of 2013, and we do. We have a 5-bedroom boutique hotel attached to us.
Let's just go through some of these items. When you talked about the Lebanese influence, point us to some of these extraordinarily rich-sounding, wonderful flavorful. I'm dying to have these lamb dishes.
I would say the lamb tartare would be my first major Lebanese influence dish. I grew up, my grandfather was from Lebanon and cooked Lebanese food often when we were at his house or he was at ours, and kibbeh, which is a traditional raw lamb dish, is really my first true culinary memory. I can remember as a little kid him giving it to me to taste it to make sure I liked it or if it was seasoned right, like, as if I knew what it's supposed to be seasoned like, but he would give it to me anyway, much to the dislike of my mother. So in that, I use the shaved onions that have been squeezed of all their liquid, so that you're just left with the sweet onion, fiber, pulp, whatever you want to call it. But it's delicious. It doesn't have any of the burn. It doesn't have the bitterness. Cinnamon, which is traditional in kibbeh. And then putting that in with the finesse of hand-cutting tartare and focusing on the size of the cut, and it's not just rough chopped. It's only cut one time, but it's very precise so that the mouthfeel is right of the meat. I think the second dish would be the Ponsonlet Bay Scallops that we're doing right now that we're honoring summer and serving patouche, which is eaten the world round, but it's tomatoes and cucumbers and onions. The Lebanese influence comes in with the za'atar and the sumac.
And you're talking about kibbeh. And in my cooking history, the problem is finding a butcher who's going to actually cut the lamb, all the sinews and all this stuff out of it, so you can make kibbeh. But that reminds me that you actually have a butchering background and a fish butchering background. Tell us about that.
I do. I apprenticed at Allen's Butcher Shop in London when I lived over there when I was going to school. It's in Mayfair across from the Connaught Hotel. I wanted to learn all I could while I was over there, and I figured if I worked for free, people were more apt to teach me something. So, and then I apprenticed at a fishmonger, a fourth-generation master fishmonger. Guy's name's David Blagden. His place is up on Paddington Street, up in Marylebone. So I worked there for a year, and then pretty much ever since that, most restaurants that I've been to since then, I've been in charge of butchering, including Fig in Charleston, where I was the full-time butcher for a year and a half.
I mean, you have so much background. Are you content to be in such a small market as Nashville?
I'm very content. I think as small as Nashville may seem, it's a big market and it's getting bigger every day. The amount of chefs moving in, the number of great restaurants opening, just the amount of people moving here, and they expect another. I think it's 1 million people in the next 10 years. Why are they moving here? Nashville's amazing. It's kind of the heartbeat of America. You can get virtually anywhere you want to go in a couple of hours via direct flights. And other than fish, or I should say other than ocean fish, seafood, I can get everything I need for the restaurant within an hour, hour and a half of here. Produce, beef, pork, lamb, chickens, all grown by local farmers, all grown with care. The animal husbandry here is amazing. The produce is amazing. I mean, we're surrounded by a lot of talented farmers.
You know, the thing that I find interesting is there are so many restaurateurs and chefs moving in from other bigger markets into Nashville. But that has to have an impact. And I think there's a big difference between chef-owned restaurants and restaurateur or owned restaurants. How does that impact you? I mean, how does it impact everybody who's a chef in Nashville? And I mean, are you on the track to open your own restaurant, or how does it affect the whole dining scene?
I think you're right. I think a lot of times a chef-driven restaurant is more about quality and artistic expression. And a little less about profit, where I think the restaurateur-driven restaurant is a little bit more about profit and less about artistic expression. I've been blessed here with investors that treat me as if I do own the place, So I get all the artistic expression I want. They've never once asked me to change something on the menu or why I'm doing something. So I kind of got the best of both worlds. I get some partners that help me to pursue the profit that you need, because you're in business to make money. I mean, that's just the reality of it. But at the same time, allow me to express my abilities to the best that I can without any compromise.
What are you doing for this Music City Wine and Food Festival?
Everything started. It started with an interview on the news at 9 this morning. I think we got there. I'm getting ready to go cook the opening event at a local restaurant here. We will be at the grand tasting tomorrow, featured in two booths: one for our own restaurant, one for Angostura Bitters. And then I'll be cooking at the after party at Pinewood Social with Smithfields. And then Sunday morning, I'm doing the food for the first gospel brunch of the Food and Wine Festival, which I'm really excited about. It's going to be fun food. It's going to be great music. And then I'm doing a tasting panel or a chef's panel about cooking wild game with Tim Love, who I think you know. And then I've got a tasting panel with Angostura, and then I got hopefully a couple hours to rest, because I'm on a plane Monday morning to Charleston.
Travis, why did you put this restaurant in a container?
I did not.
I did not put it in a container. That's it. This is as close as I'm going to get. The restaurant was designed and already built by the time I came into the team. So the architect was Nick Dryden, and it was a container because our developer had seen one in Austin and said that it was a really hip idea, and he wanted to be the first one to do it in Nashville. And the shipping container had been a pretty big movement on the West Coast. And I had actually seen it, because I came from California. And there were a lot of shipping container, both retail and living communities on the West Coast. But there wasn't any of that really east of the Mississippi that I had seen. And so when he saw it at a restaurant in Austin, he said, I think I want to put that in Nashville. So that was not me.
Now, Matt was telling us you're about to be surrounded by new hotel development.
Yes.
So that must be kind of pretty exciting, huh?
Yes.
Yes, very much. Foot traffic, as well as the out-of-town traffic that will be able to come and we hope really be pleasantly surprised by the fact that Nashville is a top food city, not only in the country, but we think now in the world. I think it's only a good thing for not only us, that's almost secondarily to the fact that for Nashville, it's going to be a boon for people to see how well we've come along culinarily.
Now there's some great things going on the beverage side of 404 Kitchen as well. Talk to us a little bit about the local beer and whiskey products and things like that you have available to you.
Well, you know, most of what we do isn't necessarily local, but we do source the best. So when I want to put something on the menu, we want to make sure that it edifies Nashville, not just because it's made in Nashville. So what we think we're doing to edify Nashville is to put on really great local products. Everybody knows about the local Jack and George whiskey, but the things that Derek is doing at Corsair, when he does a really good product, we're really happy to put it on. And the Belle Meade guys, when they did the sherry cask bourbon, I jumped right over it because I thought it was great. And locally, Jackalope and some of the other breweries, we'll put their stuff on because we think it's fantastic. So we don't necessarily put it on just because it's local, but we will put it on if it's local and people say this is fantastic. I never want somebody to come from another region where they're known for fill in the blank and come out saying, well, that was really great for Nashville. I want them just to say it was really great without the parenthetical afterwards.
Are there any thoughts of cloning or expanding 404 Kitchen?
Yeah, I think the second word is better. Cloning, I don't think could ever happen. We, you know, things are so organic when you put them together that expanding either another concept or some extra seating up top, something we do think about that on a semi-hourly basis.
We're showing her
pictures. Oh, you're showing baby pictures. Well, that's much more important. So we were going to ask Matt, but Matt's been briefly distracted. Where is 404 Kitchen? The answer is it's at 404. The street is 12th Avenue South. It's in a mystery neighborhood to us as strangers, called the Gulch. We are continuing to struggle ourselves, Anne and Peter, to understand why everyone thinks the Gulch is so fascinating. But we know it's going to get there, and 404 Kitchen is going to be a big part of it. We're looking forward to dining with you, Travis.
I mean, the fact is that when I first came to Nashville, I was blown away by the fact that they had turned the old Union Station, the train station, into a really beautiful hotel. So for folks like myself who are looking at Nashville, the growth of it is fantastic, but when you grow around the history, that actually is even more appreciated by people like myself. So these railroad tracks, which is, you know, the old buildings around here, why it was called the Gulch, it's, you know, that sort of lowered area, and the railroad tracks in Commodore Vanderbilt's day that made Nashville a pretty big hub, they're still there. So having a modern growth around the old history, I think is actually quite nice.
I mean, are you going to distract yourself again?
Yeah, exactly. Maybe pictures always distract people.
Say goodnight, it's time to go cook for you.
Say that again?
Say goodnight, it's time to go cook for you.
Hey, goodnight, guys, it's time to go cook for you.
And yes, it is a busy place, as you can tell from the background noise, but well worth going to. Really interesting crowd, interesting story, interesting food, interesting drink. What else would you like? And now we're going to take a break, and we'll be back with a final guest, a surprise guest, shall we call it.
Podcasting services for On the Menu Radio are provided by ASP Station, www.aspstation.net.
To the final segment of today's program, and we mentioned a surprise.
Yeah, the big surprise actually was that we were able to catch up with Scott Cousins.
Yeah, there you go.
Because it's been, I think we figured out that the last time we talked to him was in 2005.
he's a kind of a busy guy, but somehow or other they persuaded him to come to Nashville. You'll find
he's a spokesperson, of course, for Infiniti, which is one of the sponsors, and it's a gorgeous car.
Right, that too, but it's better yet, Scott was telling everybody who could find a seat how to make delicious food, and he talked to us about delicious food, about why he bothered to come to Nashville and what he's been up to recently and what he's going to be up to in the future. So an interesting conversation with Scott.
Actually, I don't think Scott kind of knows this, but I have been a secret panting fan of his for years. I'm so glad to see you, and it's been years since we talked.
It's been a very long time. I mean, probably 2008, if not before 2004, maybe. But thank you. That's very kind. It's very kind. It's always nice to hear that, and I think I'm blushing right now, so I appreciate it. Thank you.
Much has happened to you. You volunteered the information that you're now married with children.
I am. When I come to events like that, like this, I have to remind myself of that. Today is actually my three-year-old's birthday, as a matter of fact. So I keep getting pictures from my wife that she's so happy and running around, so excited. And I have a five-and-a-half-year-old as well. So, yeah, it's good. That's the best part of life.
Seems you've settled down quite a lot since last we talked. I started to ask you, what restaurants do you still have in New York? But I think you said none, but you're working on something. Tell us, bring us up to date on your restaurant cooking career.
So I have a Scarpetta in Miami. I have Corsair by Scott Conant in Aventura, Florida. I have DOCG and Scarpetta in Las Vegas at the Cosmopolitan Hotel. And I have Scarpetta at the Montage in Beverly Hills as well. And I'm working currently in New York City on a restaurant called Conant, which would be kind of, as I'm moving forward and I'm looking at new things to do and I'm as I'm doing new, fun, exciting adventures, both nationally and internationally, Conant will be my brand beacon, so to speak. So that's what I'm most excited about working on at the moment. And it's, you know, these are the most fun elements of creating a restaurant, because right now we could do anything. I mean, I'm looking at China and I'm looking at dishes and menu setups and graphics and all the fun things and uniforms and service styles and approaches and sequence of service for customers. And, you know, what's the best way to make customers happy? Right? That's the ultimate goal.
But you were so fine-tuned into the New York dining scene. What has you in Florida and Vegas? And
life is a series of opportunities sometimes. And when these opportunities look good, it's about growth and potential. You know, unfortunately, it doesn't make economic sense to have one restaurant in New York City anymore. I feel like restaurants now need to start to look the way fashion brands looked years ago, where you have your flagship, so to speak, and then you could build the tentacles out from where that flagship resides. And New York is my home. I have an office there, and we do private events in the space. It's called Scott Conant Culinary Suite. And if you're in New York, I insist that you come by and see what we do there. It's so much fun. I have a beautiful kitchen. It's a great loft space in Soho, and we have really a beautiful property that overlooks Manhattan. But most importantly, I do videos there. I do food photography. I do all kinds of things. And then at night, we do events for up to 36 people, sit-down dinner, or 65 for cocktail parties.
So you haven't really slowed down.
There's no slowing down.
We didn't mention that we're interviewing Scott Conant in Nashville, Tennessee, which has a slender combination with New York City, because Cornelius Vanderbilt, who built things all around New York City on rails, did the same in Nashville, Tennessee, we think. And beyond that, we're sitting at a beautifully set table next to the Infinity tent, which is a little more high-tech than a tent. Tell us about the Scott Conant Infinity connection.
We do a lot of work together with Infinity. I mean, it's a great brand. It's a wonderful car company. And I feel like there's a lot of similarities and a lot of... it's a peer brand is the way I like to think about it. So... you know, we do a lot of these events together because Infinity has a great relationship with different food festivals around the country. And I do fun cooking events. I mean, cooking demos. And I'm going to make risotto in like 15 minutes. So, you know, I do a show called Chopped. And some people kind of give me a little bit of grief because I get really, I'm very particular about the way pasta and risotto in particular are cooked. So I'm going to show the reason why, basically.
Well, that brings us back to, you've always been associated with Italian cooking. Now, I mean, are you Italian at all?
My mother's family is Italian. So, yeah, I mean, the expression is you are what your mother is. So I guess, yes.
So all of your concepts flirt or center on Italian.
Yeah, I mean, you know, I don't like to think of them as concepts because things are a little bit too personal for me to be a concept. And the intention is never to do a rollout, so to speak. Although I don't necessarily think it's out of the cards in the future to do something that I could put in different cities. But the fact of the matter is that, yes, they're all kind of fancy, high-end Italian restaurants, yeah.
Do you ever long for a Shake Shack?
All the time. All the time. And when I'm on the West Coast, In-N-Out Burger is that's the go-to spot, absolutely.
How do you find the scene, the culinary scene in changing in New York. I think it's changed a lot.
You know, there's so many young chefs that are coming into their own. It's funny. I don't know when I became a veteran, but I'm a veteran now. I mean, it's unbelievable. Right? I think it's a quick transition, although it takes a long time to get there. But when it happens very fast. You know, there's so many young chefs, and there's a certain style of cooking today that a lot of these young chefs are taking advantage of. And the products are getting better, and there's more compassion towards the customer, and there's more attention towards the product, and most importantly, there's more detailed focus from the chefs. And I just think that makes for a better cuisine, a better culinary landscape.
Flip it and tell us your experiences when you're on the road and with shows like this, like Nashville. We have restaurateurs from every other city moving in here.
Yeah. Well, there's opportunities in these places, and the good news is, you know, you have a chef like Jonathan Waxman who can open Adele's, and I think he's working on other concepts as well. You have Manny Chowand, who's one of my colleagues, actually, on Chopped. She just bought a brewery, as a matter of fact. So she has a restaurant, now she's doing a brewery, she's going to do products. I mean, you know, those are the type of, what I love about it is that chefs are becoming more and more entrepreneurial, and there's opportunities for us that we didn't necessarily have 15 years ago, or it was really those opportunities were for a very select few, and now it's opened up, and there's multiple situations where various chefs are taking their brands internationally.
Well, we could go on in length of that. I'm going to ask you one last question. Is you say that they're spreading out, chefs are becoming more entrepreneurial, and they're doing different, aside from your secret urge to hit on something like In-N-Out Burger, Nancy Silverton, for example, has just started making gelato. Do you have any hidden surprises that will be coming out about you?
I wish. I mean, Nancy is a genius, and you're not going to find a bigger fan. You're not going to find a bigger fan of Nancy Silverton than me. I happen to think that what she does is she's always brand focused. She's always about elevating those commodities of Italian cuisine and breads, for example. I mean, who's a better baker than she is in the world? So I don't think I have any of those things up my sleeve. I'm open for the opportunities, or, you know, I'd love to channel them one of these days. But at the moment, I'm really happy, content, satisfied, and excited for the Conant brand restaurant, Conant, that I'm building in the future.
Well, and good luck with your continuing relationship to Infinity, which I understand you drive one. I would like to drive one.
Thank you for stopping by. Infinity is proud to be able to sponsor you folks and have you here today. Thank you.
And we'll be back with Laura from Nashville next week. And in the meantime, what do we say until then? Oh, bye-bye. There we go.
Bye-bye. I jumped the gun.